Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, club chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair for this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Lawrence Diller, who will introduce our speaker, Dr. David Healy. Dr. Diller is a pediatric psychiatrist, pediatrician, with a license plate called Moral RX. Moral RX.
I get stopped all the time thinking I'm some evangelical guy with that license plate, but the license plate actually suggests that while medications do work in children's behavior, they aren't the moral equivalent to non-drug interventions that call for engagement with the child. That's Moral RX. But and it's my interest, therefore, as a behavioral pediatrician, and my drug happens to be Ritalin or Adderall, and David's drug was Prozac at one point that brought us together. Very quickly, I want you to know that David is an Irish psychiatrist. He's a professor in psychological medicine at Cardiff University School of Medicine in Wales. He is a head of an inpatient psychiatric unit there. He's published many books, among them The Psychopharmacologist, The Antidepressant Era, the Creation of Psychopharmacology, Let Them Eat Prozac, Shock Therapy, Mania, A Short History of Bipolar Disorder. That's the data on David. I want to tell one quick story to indicate how one individual can change things. I was attending – the first time I met David was at the 2004 FDA hearings on suicide and Prozac in youth. David had brought to the MHRA, the FDA equivalent, in 2003, his data showing that the SSRIs really weren't working in children. There was this interesting blip of suicides in the children who were taking it. With that, the MHRA decided, well, maybe Prozac is the only one we can really use it with the National Health Service, and really forced the hand of the FDA, our regulatory agency, to take a look at Prozac with children. At the first hearings in 2004, it came out, again through David's work, in this case working with attorneys, that there were seven extant published studies on the SSRIs and children's depression, of which three showed positive effects of the drugs, four didn't. What was unbeknownst until that hearing in 2004, there were eight other studies that were done by the drug companies so they could extend their patents on medicine but were never published. Of those eight, all eight had no findings, no useful positive findings for the SSRI. So it turns out there were only three studies and 12 negative studies. When asked why these studies weren't published, one of the representatives of the drug company says it wasn't in the fiduciary interests of our stockholders to publish these papers. When this came out, you could feel the earth moving underneath us at the conference, and whether or not the ice was breaking or it was a tectonic shift in suddenly the public's attitude, because here was money clearly trumping the health of children. And I can tell you that it really takes the death of children to cause change in our country. And indeed, since that hearing, of the subsequent hearing, a woman got up and turned to the FDA officials, pointing her finger at them and saying, "You killed my child." Hey, you know what? That gets the attention of the press, and it gets the attention of the doctors, and it gets the attention of Senator Grassley, and there has been a shift. I can tell you, I suffered under this insanity of drug companies undermining my credibility for many, many years, and I was speaking up. But this man led to this change. He's going to talk about it. It still hasn't changed enough, all right? But he started this, in my opinion. David Healy.
Well, they were extremely generous words, Larry, and thank you very much. And I'm also awfully pleased to be here. I don't know who you all are. It's a mixed group, I'm sure. I know a little bit about you. Hopefully the talk is going to appeal to all of you, though, and it may well be that those of you who aren't within healthcare will have a better feel for the issues that are going to come out in this talk than those of you who are in the field. What I'm going to be talking about is the eclipse of medical care. And the roots of this talk go back over 100 years, where doctors like these two doctors here argued at the TOS about changes happening within the field of medicine back then. What we were having 100 years ago were new tests that ultimately led to new cures, and a greater focus on these tests, and a greater focus on trying to cure the patient. Other doctors, however, in the face of progress like this, said, well, it's all very well to have progress, but we need to ensure that we don't lose our feel for treating the whole person, that we don't stop caring. Now, for 100 years after that, for the most part, we've opted for cures. The feeling has been that if you have a cure, that this is a good form of care, that you may have a doctor who says, have a nice day to you, and has a good bedside approach, but if you've got a doctor who, even if they haven't got a good bedside approach, is going to give you a treatment that actually gets you well, most of us have opted for the doctor who gets you well. And in recent years, we've appeared to have evidence-based medicine as a means to try and help doctors actually deliver real cures and perhaps also care a bit more. Evidence-based medicine was the application of controlled trials to the drug to the various different drugs brought on the market by the industry, and the hope was that this would rein in the hype about these drugs and bring to light their risks, so that doctors could both ensure that we got appropriate cures and ensure at the same time that we got the best possible care. Evidence-based medicine, as it's framed here, you see, had three poles to it. Evidence, the expertise of the doctor, and the values of the patient. But there's been a shift, and under the influence of the fact, perhaps, that most trials that get done these days, most of the evidence that's produced is produced by the pharmaceutical companies, we've ended up with a world that looks a bit more like this, which is that the evidence, which was supposed to be part of the picture, has come to trump everything else. It's come to trump any wisdom the doctor may have, any inclination she may have not to rush you on to the latest new treatment, for instance. And, of course, it's come to trump the values and the voice of the patient also. This has been relegated to the status of an anecdote. We are in a world where we get more and better drugs the whole time, and we've got evidence-based medicine, so we're getting more and better evidence the whole time. So we shouldn't be getting a situation like this, which is that we have a new illness out there that is at least the fourth leading cause of death. It may be even the leading cause of death in areas of healthcare such as the mental health field. This is an illness that has astronomic treatment costs. We spend more trying to treat the consequences of this illness than we do on the entire drugs budget. Every other illness, like hypertension and asthma and diabetes, comes with guidelines for their treatment. This is an illness with no guidelines. It's got no evidence base for its treatment, and it's even got no name, which makes it very hard to grapple with. So there's an illness out there killing us and killing our children and relatives and parents. Killing people in the years when they retire and should be enjoying the fruits of their work more than any other group. We're vaguely aware that things aren't right, and we put it down mostly to conflict of interest, that there's a few academics who are being paid by the pharmaceutical companies to run research and give lectures, and because they've been paid, this has turned their heads, and they're just saying the kinds of things that suit industry. And if only we got to grips with this and ensured they weren't paid by companies, everything would be okay. Well, that's not the problem. The problem, I believe, has to do with a system that we put in place in 1962 after a sleeping pill that was being used at the time caused birth defects. We were trying to ensure that this couldn't happen again. So one of the things we did was to try and reward companies for bringing the right kind of drugs on the market by giving them product patents on their drugs as opposed to process patents or other kinds of arrangements. Product patents gave companies the incentive to make blockbuster drugs. These are drugs that earn $1 billion per year or more for the pharmaceutical industry. We created the kind of conditions where it became in the interests of the company to hype hugely the benefits their drugs could bring about and, more to the point, hide the risks. We created the kind of situation where often a single drug was crucial to the life of the pharmaceutical company. Whatever it might do for our health, it was crucial for the health of the company. And in those kind of circumstances, as you see in this quote here about Prozac and the risk that it might make people go on to become suicidal, the company had the incentive to hide the risks in order to make sure there was no problem for the health of Prozac, because if Prozac went down, the company was going to go down with it. These are the kinds of circumstances which make medicines less safe for all of us. The other thing we did in 1962, the other element to the system, was to make drugs available on prescription only. Her body, her choice, my decision, whether she gets an oral contraceptive in this case or not. Prescription-only arrangements were put in place back in 1914 to control drugs like opiates and cocaine. In 1951, there was a move to extend them to all new drugs, and this was copper-fastened in place in 1962 because it was felt that people knew very little about their own health, and they weren't going to be skeptical about new pills the way doctors would be. Doctors would be slow to use these new pills. But we hadn't recognized things like Stockholm Syndrome back then. Stockholm Syndrome was first described after this bank, as it was then, and a department store, as it is now, in Stockholm was raided. The people in the bank were held hostage at threat to their lives for 5 days. This was conditions in which they were isolated. There was a real threat. But it turned out that their captors were kind. These seemed to be extremely nice captors. And so when they were liberated and met the media afterwards, the media were actually astonished to find that the people that came out of the bank were singing the praises of the people who had been holding them hostage, the people who had threatened their lives. And this led to the recognition of the fact that if you're isolated and there's a threat to your life, and in particular if there's a kind captor, you're at risk of Stockholm Syndrome. You're going to identify with the person holding you hostage. And of course, this is what happens to any of us when we're ill. We're isolated, there's a threat to our life, and our doctors these days are increasingly trained to be nice to us, to say, have a nice day. But they aren't trained to recognize that if they ask us, is there a problem on the pills, and we say, fine, that actually we may just be trying to keep them happy rather than saying what's actually happening to us on the pills. The other way to put this is this. If you're on a flight from the West Coast here to the East Coast, the pilot is on board with you. Your safety is her safety. If the plane goes down, she ends up dead as well. That's not the case when you get a drug from your doctor. She's not on board on the flight that she's put you on. If you go down, it's very unfortunate, but it could have been the illness you had that brought you down rather than her pill. So she doesn't often report what happened. And the third element of the system that we put in place was controlled trials. We were going to persuade companies to ensure that the drugs that they brought on the market worked and were reasonably safe. And how were we going to do that? We were going to get them to put their drugs through controlled trials before they were brought on the market. So let me show you a controlled trial. Here's an extremely famous one. It's Study 329, which shows Paxil works for children who are depressed. It appears in the journal with the highest impact factor in the field, with an authorship line of the best names in the field. Any doctor reading this article by these authors in this journal would say, I should be giving this drug to children who are depressed and nervous. It's going to be helpful. The article says the drug works well and is safe. 3 years before this article was published, however, within SmithKline Beecham, who make Paxil or made it, there was this document produced where the company recognizes that Study 329 shows that our drug does not work in children who are depressed and is not safe. The data are so bad that we cannot show them to FDA. They later worked out how they could show them to FDA and were reasonably confident that FDA would miss the problem, and they did show them to FDA, and FDA did miss the problem. But in the interim, they'd worked out a strategy, which was to take the good bits of the data and publish them. And that's what you've seen in the previous article. New York State later took an action against GSK for fraud based on that and won. What you didn't see in the previous article was the true author of the study, and that's a woman called Sally Layden, whom you see here. What you've got is an email from one of the people in the company to her, saying, "Look, I know what the data looks like. I know the authors of the article haven't complained about the issues or haven't raised any issues. That's in part because even though they're the authors of the article, they haven't seen the data. But the company person here has. And he says, you've done a wonderful job hiding the risks to the point where even I and the company am feeling a little bit nervous about this. I'm going to have to go back and reassure myself that everything's okay." Right. Is this an unusual situation? Well, the answer is no. Let's have a look here at the trials for adults that brought these antidepressants onto the market. What you see here is a bunch of trials, for the most part in white, which means that they're positive publications. These are journal articles on studies that have been done that brought each of the antidepressants here, the ones that we use day to day, onto the market. And three negative studies that you see there in black. And if you look at the column third from the right there, which has the white boxes 61 and 62 in it, what we've got is groups in medicine like the Cochrane Review body, whose brief it is to be completely independent of the pharmaceutical industry and to review all of the evidence about all of the drugs for asthma or lipid lowering or gut problems or antidepressants, and to work out what does the evidence really point to. You've got the industry saying one thing, but when we get all of the evidence together, what does this show? And the Cochrane group, looking at all of the evidence, said that the antidepressant we should all be using is Zoloft. There's two positive trials here. It's 100% positive. It isn't the only drug, as you see there, that's 100% positive. But, and here's the article by the Cochrane Review Group, which says just this. And it appears in one of the best journals in the field. So, again, it's the kind of thing that's going to be hugely influential. But FDA see more than the published articles. The Cochrane reviewers only get to see the published articles. FDA get to see more. They got to see all of these studies. And as you see now, half of the studies of the antidepressants were negative. And look in particular at the third column from the right, the Zoloft column. You now see there's only one white box and four black boxes. If you're going to pick out the antidepressant that was the least effective to use, the one that we should use last, based on data like this, you'd pick Zoloft. What happened to the fact that there were two white boxes before? Well, of all the white boxes that you saw before, they were all, for the most part, written by ghostwriters. One third of them were trials that the FDA had said are negative trials of the drug, but ghostwriters had polished to make look positive, like study 329. This is the data as of 2004. These are bits, excerpts from the publications of Paxil and Zoloft for children as of 2004, when concerns blew up about the antidepressants making children become suicidal. As you see here, the articles say safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. As you've heard, the opening introduction actually by Larry said that when the regulators got to see the data, they realized that in almost all cases, the data pointed to the fact that the trials were negative. This is the greatest divide in all of medicine between what the data says on the one hand and what the published articles say on the other hand. It's also a 100% ghostwritten literature. Now, what this is of importance, I mean, you know, you may all be concerned about the treatment of children, but what's true here is true for any of the pills that any of you in this room are on, whether you're on asthma pills, lipid-lowering pills, osteoporosis pills, any other pill. It's the same situation that you're facing. You can see the problems for children being treated with these pills. Well, it's the same for any of us here in the room or anyone we know who's on any pills. You know, there are the same processes are involved for all pills. What does ghost writing do for you? Well, it does things like this. It produces the kind of situation you see here. This is the distribution of the suicidal acts in the trials that brought these three drugs to the market. If you look at the published articles, however, and see how the medical writers portrayed what was happening on these drugs about people becoming suicidal, what you find is this. The tricks involve things like ghostwriters and others saying that, well, patients up here who have been on a previous drug and before they go into the active trial have been removed from the previous drug, so they're on no drug at all here, well, that's the same as being on placebo, isn't it? So why don't we just include these suicidal acts here under the heading of placebo? This breaches regulations. FDA was aware of it happening, and FDA did nothing about it. It isn't just true for these antidepressants. It's true also for almost every drug crisis as regards drugs like Vioxx and Avandia. I'm going to go on to a further trick here that the company's doing. This is probably the most important trick they do. I'm going to leave out two or three tricks, and if we've got time at the end and you're interested to see more about the tricks companies do, we can bring them into play. But here's a key trick. And again, for those of you who don't know much math, this may seem daunting to begin with, but you're probably going to have a better appreciation of what's going on here than many people within healthcare who think they do understand the math. We do trials because these days we don't trust the judgment of an individual doctor. So we recruit maybe 100 people to the trial. And if you do that and the drug does nothing much, there'll be people who've appeared to improve on the drug and people who've appeared to get worse on the drug. And overall, the curve will look like this, that the peak of the curve will be over the point 1.0. That means that this drug doesn't do anything, one way or the other. If it did good, the curve shifts to the left, and if it does poorly, the curve shifts to the right. Let me show you what the curves for Prozac and suicide look like. When the fuss blew up about Prozac making people suicidal, the company's response was, well, these reports that we get from doctors of people going on Prozac and becoming suicidal and it clears up when you stop the Prozac and comes back when you go on the Prozac again, these are just anecdotes. We've done the trials, and the trials, the science shows just the opposite. And this is an article that appears in the BMJ, which is read by 100,000 people, most of whom have no links to the pharmaceutical industry at all, and none of them spotted what the company did with this article, which is this. When you add the suicidal acts that happened here on Prozac and the ones that happened on placebo, and map them out in just the same kind of curve that I've showed you earlier, if you recall, what I said was if the results are favorable for Prozac, the curve should shift left. If the results aren't favorable for Prozac, the curve shifts right. You've got double the risk of people becoming suicidal on Prozac than on placebo. But the company could put data like this into the BMJ and be reasonably confident that no one would see a problem with Prozac because, as they said, that the data shows that there's no statistically significant differences between the rates at which people are becoming suicidal on Prozac and the rates at which they're becoming suicidal on placebo. Now, we can all agree with that. The data is not statistically significant. But what you shouldn't have agreed with is the next statement, which is this. Data from these trials do not show that Prozac is associated with an increased risk, when in fact, that's exactly what the data does show. What the company's appealing to here is the fact that if the findings could have happened but by chance, if there's any chance that chance played a part in it, then they're asking you to assume there's no increase in risk, that actually what you've just seen here is the play of chance. This is the ultimate version of a strategy that was pioneered by the tobacco industry in the first instance under the heading, Doubt is Our Product. To bring the point home, let me skip to the next slide. What you've got is two drugs, drug A and drug B. They're both helpful, okay? But what you've got is with drug A is a twofold increase in risk that you might go on to a heart attack on this drug also. It could help, but there's a risk of it causing a heart attack, like Vioxx perhaps. And then you've got drug B, which can also be helpful, but there's an eightfold increase in the risk that it may cause you to have a heart attack. In public, and in the BMJ, and in most of our leading journals, the company will say the only risky drug is drug A because the data is statistically significant. But in private, if I'm working for one of the pharmaceutical companies and asked to treat my wife, our children, our parents, I will give them drug A rather than drug B. What the companies are actually saying to you is drug B comes with no risks at all because the data is not statistically significant, but in fact, it's four times riskier. We can come back to this point if I haven't made it absolutely clear. Let me skip that slide and give you this. But here's the ultimate trick. The two tables here are exactly the same size and shape. Most of you who haven't seen this before aren't going to believe it. You'd probably have to print off the slide and you're welcome. I'm happy to give anyone who's here all of the slides afterwards. You have to print it off and superimpose each of the tables, or one of the tables, one on the left on the one on the right, to persuade yourself that actually they are the same. I mean, they are. When you do it, they turn out to be just the same size and shape. But even when you do that, you still don't see them as being the same size and shape. The data doesn't overcome the spin, the illusion. Now, companies have a wonderful way to do exactly the same thing with clinical trial data, and it's to introduce the thing that creates the illusion, the thing that creates that creates the perspective that the two tables are different here. In the case of clinical trials, is the illness. We've talked about, and you hear in the media the whole time, in all the articles you read, TV news, things like that, companies do drug trials. They don't. Everything you hear about is an illness trial. And illnesses, if you do a trial of a drug in an illness, the illness hides the problems on the pill. They also do drug trials. These are usually called phase one or healthy volunteer trials. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about one quickly, briefly. With all the material that you're hearing about now, with the tricks that I've outlined here, with this particular bit of the story, and with a bunch more tricks, you can find all of the material on a blog, davidhealy.org. Let me tell you about this. In Leeds, in the UK, in 1983, 9 years before Pfizer launched Zoloft on the market in the US, 21 years before they were forced by FDA to put a black box warning on Zoloft that it could cause people to become suicidal, Pfizer had given Zoloft to, well, they'd run a trial of Zoloft, a drug trial of Zoloft, in 12 healthy volunteers in Leeds, UK, six of whom got Zoloft and the other six got placebo. The six women who got Zoloft dropped out of the trial after 4 to 5 days. They had become anxious, apprehensive. They had begun to voice concerns about being aggressive, and they had other strange and unusual thoughts. When you have a problem like this happening in an illness, if you run a trial of Zoloft in people who are depressed, the anxiety and the apprehension and the thoughts of suicide and violence get masked by the same problems happening with the illness. So that the company can attribute what's happening to the illness and not the pill. And this is the same for trials of drugs that are used for asthma, for osteoporosis drugs, for lipid-lowering drugs. The illness can always mask the problem caused by the drug. But in 1983, based on just six people going on Zoloft, Pfizer concluded Zoloft has caused this. Not only that, they had concluded that other companies with SSRIs had also done healthy volunteer trials and seen the same thing, and they had said that it's well known SSRIs make people anxious, apprehensive, make them suicidal, etc. But this trial remained unpublished, as all healthy volunteer trials do. We've made moves in recent years to getting clinical trials, illness trials, registered. The companies still don't hand over the data from those because they say there's issues of patient confidentiality involved. Healthy volunteer trials aren't registered at all. But if they were, which we ought to lobby for, there would be no patient confidentiality issues. We should be able to get the trials registered, and we should be able to get the data as well. And data like this would make the practice of medicine a great deal safer. It was evident to Pfizer that Zoloft was making people anxious and apprehensive. There's a curiosity about the word evidence-based medicine. In French and German and Dutch and most non-English languages, evidence means it is evident, as in it is evident you shouldn't jump out of a plane without a parachute. It's obvious. Evidence-based medicine in English, however, means it is proven. And this often means it is proven that you should take a pill that's not obviously good for you. The trials that bring the SSRIs on the market, I could put alcohol, good Californian, Pinot, Grigio, or whatever, through the same kind of trials and show that for people who are anxious or depressed, that it was an effective antidepressant. You'd know, however, that these trials that only last possibly about 6 weeks, that maybe having alcohol for this period, good wine for this period, is helpful, but you'd also know that it's not a great idea to have it for months or years. But you're being told about the SSRIs and the antidepressants that you should be on these drugs for months and years when we really don't have the evidence that this is the case. we treat SSRIs and prescription drugs as though they're much safer than things like alcohol and nicotine and cocaine and things like that, even though these new drugs are available on prescription only, precisely because we don't know what the risks are, and we have every reason to think that the risks may well turn out to be greater than alcohol and nicotine and cocaine and Valium and stimulants. We're in a world where 50 years ago, cars didn't come with seat belts or airbags. Now, if you got a BMW, you'll not only have a seat belt and airbag in it, but the car often won't start if you haven't put the seat belt on. Drugs used to come with a poison symbol on them. Cars have moved from being unsafe to being an awful lot safer. The poison symbol has been removed from drugs. If in an expert report I mention one of the most famous phrases in all of medicine, which is up on the top here on the left in German, that every drug is a poison and the art of medicine lies in being able to get the right dose, it will be struck out by the lawyers for the pharmaceutical companies who say mentioning that drugs are poison is prejudicial against the company's product. Instead, this is a serious proposal, we actually instead have calls for a symbol like the one you see down on the right here, lower right, which is to put a stamp like this on antidepressants for pregnant women to try and reassure them it's safe to take an antidepressant during pregnancy. We put control trials in place in order to ensure that the problems caused by thalidomide didn't happen again. As of 1962, the only drug that had been through a placebo-controlled trial before it was brought to the market, a placebo-controlled trial in which it would turn out to be extremely safe and very effective, it was effective and was safe, was thalidomide. The system we put in place to stop this happening again is a system through which this drug sailed perfectly. We have a world now where the antidepressants have become the most commonly used drugs in pregnancy. Up to 15% of pregnant women are on an antidepressant, even though the evidence accumulates that they cause birth defects, miscarriages, and may delay the development of children born to women who are on them. It's a world where women don't take alcohol because it's too risky, even though it isn't actually risky to have a glass of wine every so often if you're out while you're pregnant. They don't smoke, they don't eat soft cheeses, they don't take uncooked meats, they don't take hot showers, but they're being told by their doctor they should be taking Paxil and Zoloft and Prozac. Why? Because it's the disease. The disease is the unique source of the poison. The nerves, if you leave them untreated, will cause birth defects. The idea that a prescription drug could be a poison has just gone off the radar completely. This is professional suicide for doctors. When the fuss blew up about the antidepressants causing children to become suicidal that you've heard about at the start, actually from Larry when he introduced me, the APA rushed out this statement here in response to FDA's black box warning on the antidepressants that we believe antidepressants save lives. This is a professional suicide note. What APA should have said was that we believe psychiatrists save lives by recognizing that the drugs aren't always hugely effective and that they do come with risks, and it takes an expert to use these drugs safely. Because if it's the antidepressants which are extremely effective and are risk-free, well, there are a lot cheaper people out there who can prescribe now these days than psychiatrists. We risk putting ourselves out of business if we're not careful. What is the fourth leading cause of death? Well, it's treatment-induced injury. I put up here the proposal that we call this illness, that we call this new illness pharmacosis. The hint there is that there's a loss of insight involved. If we're going to treat this illness, the guidelines for treating the illness will involve guidelines for people rather than guidelines for an illness. The key data is going to be comparative safety data rather than comparative efficacy data, as in the healthy volunteer trials. It's the point where cure and care meet. If you're going to cure this illness, you've got to passionately care about the patient. You've got to put the person you're treating in front of everything else. If you're convinced the drug is causing the problem, you may have to stand up to what appears to be the evidence base. Broadly speaking, just to the end, there's two ways we can approach problems like this. We can take a shower or bidet approach. The shower is the top-down approach and the bidet is the bottom-up approach. We'll need components of both. The shower approach would involve having to redo elements of the system that we put in place back in 62. We've got to look at the issue about how we reward companies for bringing new drugs on the market. We've got to look at elements of the prescription-only arrangements that we have for drugs. This isn't saying get rid of them. As a doctor who makes a living out of drugs being available on prescription only, I'm not trying to say let's get rid of this completely. But we do need to train doctors to recognize the marketing targets they've become and how things like Stockholm syndrome can happen. We need to argue that if control trials that are being done by the companies in illnesses, that we should have access to the data from those trials. It's people like us that take risks in trials to bring drugs to the market. A drug is a chemical that comes with information. The companies make the chemical. You make the information. It's the risks that you take. You take these risks on the understanding that other people, if you're injured, will get access to the information that's come out of the risk that you take. You wouldn't have agreed to get involved in these trials often if you were told that the company is going to sequester the information away to the point where the information that now comes with the chemical is as poisonous or more poisonous than the chemical. The bidet approach would try and foster a culture in which we get doctors and patients to believe the evidence of their own eyes a great deal more than they do at the moment. It turns out when we go back and have a look at reports on people on the adverse events caused by drugs that more than 80% of the reports turn out to be right. And it's not just reports by doctors. Reports on, for instance, the effects that oral contraceptives have on hair, which were almost for sure not made by doctors in the first instance, but were made by the women that went on the oral contraceptives, or maybe made by their hairdressers, turn out to be right. These things are often very evident. We need to restore confidence in people to say what is actually happening, because ultimately this is still the single best way to discover new drugs. As companies have cut off the ability of anyone to talk about the adverse events on a drug, so also the pipeline of new drugs has dried up. We need, as I've said, to put a greater emphasis on comparative safety research, a greater emphasis on doing drug trials as opposed to illness trials, and a much greater emphasis on patient reporting. As I said to you, when you compare doctors and pilots, when the pilot reports on a near miss or an error problem in the plane, it's not treated as an anecdote. People pay heed to it and the system adjusts. When doctors report on adverse events, they often don't. I mean, they only report 5% of the serious adverse events that happen on drugs these days. They don't report the range of other things that are happening that are potentially even more important. The minor problems like being dizzy briefly on a drug for 15 seconds or so every two or three days. Why would I report this? Well, it turns out that with one of the heart drugs we have, that exactly this problem led to people crashing their cars and led to a lot of people, because of a crashed car, losing their license and losing their jobs. There were huge consequences of this, and it was not reported by doctors. So, the talk you've just heard is outlined in greater detail on the blog that I've isolated, that I've outlined here. Also, a book that has just come out, which is ultimately the talk that you've just heard. And one more thing, which is with a group of colleagues, we've opened up www.risk.org, which is in beta form at the moment. This is going to be a website where ultimately, where you are at this point in time able to go in and research the side effects that may be happening on the drug you're on. But ultimately, within a few weeks' time, we're hoping that you're going to be able to go in and report on the side effects that you're having on the drug that you're on also. Our hope is that if we can get people, and it turns out when FDA look at the reports that come from patients on drugs compared to the reports from doctors about the problems on drugs, that the patient reports are much better quality than the doctor reports are. Our hope is that with a greater volume of patient reports on drugs, we may well be able to change the culture of medicine, not just having good quality reports, but putting people in touch with other people who are having the same kinds of problems, letting people know that hundreds of other people have reported the same thing, and that other doctors have agreed that they think there is a link between the drug and the problem also. Things like this are a way to try and reverse the Stockholm syndrome problems that come with the availability of drugs on prescription only. You will be invited to ask your doctor if this isn't the drug for you. You'll be invited to get him or her to help you work as a team to try and put the problems that I've outlined here right. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. Now the program of Dr. Healy is open for questions. Please use the microphone.
I raised three sons, and I've never taken any of these things. Why do people take these things? I mean, it's criminal. I watch people, my friends, take these pills. I don't get it. I mean, how do they, since 62, they've bought into this pill program. I don't get it.
Well, part of the problem is this, that companies, you see the adverts for pills, and, clearly a very large proportion of the people here in this room are probably the kind of people who see all these adverts about people happy on Paxil or happy on Socar, and they don't buy it. They know they're just being sold things. But that's not the way the company really markets these things. Often they'll market the illness, and they'll market fear, that if you don't treat this illness, for instance, in the case of children who are depressed, the marketing was, if you don't treat your child for being depressed, they're going to end up alcoholic with career failure, they'll go on to suicide, they'll have a range of other problems. But even beyond that, the company markets measurement tools. In the case of the osteoporosis drugs, they gave away DEXA scanners for free. They know that if they can get doctors to measure things, a little bit of bone thinning here or there in a woman over the age of 50 becomes a problem for the doctor and the woman, for which a pill is an easy answer. When I began clinical practice first, osteoporosis was a terribly rare condition. I worked in an orthopedic clinic, and you'd expect to see one or two cases per year. Now we're told that one-third of women over the age of 50 have osteoporosis. So this is how it's done. It's extraordinarily subtle. And it almost, when you have an illness, as opposed to using a pill for whatever, if you have an illness, if the company markets an illness, it's almost a moral compunction on us to put an illness right. Doctors feel obliged to put an illness right.
I just finished reading a book called Checklist by Dr. Gawanda, and he makes a comparison similar to yours to the airline industry. And I'm curious, he says those doctors, and he's proved that a checklist improves his own surgical results. And I'm wondering why doctors are so immune or unable to accept the fact that they aren't omnipotent or omniscient.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. It's a part of the problem at the moment is that if a drug's available on prescription only and I put you on it, I've got to recognize that I may have made a mistake when things go wrong. And that's tricky for all of us. Where if I do get to the stage of being able to recognize that the pill I put you on has caused you a problem and take you off it and let my colleagues know that this pill seems to cause this particular problem, I'm in a world where I'm going to meet colleagues who don't want to hear that message. They're being wined and dined by the industry. Their best friends come from industry and things like this. It's a message. It's a world that industry has been able to craft extremely well. So it's not doctors anymore who think they're let me come back and answer. Doctors don't think they're omnipotent anymore. That's part of the problem. I almost wish they did. Doctors have regressed to childhood, and they think there's a Wizard of Oz figure out there who has the answers, and it's FDA, and it's people who write the guidelines. Now, the guidelines we have all get written, can only be written by people who look at the evidence, and the evidence is all produced by the companies. And in the case of FDA, which is really just a bunch of bureaucrats, it's not super scientists. These are people often who've retreated from medicine into the bureaucracy. FDA are encouraged these days. If they once did stand up to industry, they are encouraged these days to partner industry. That's explicitly written into the regulations for how FDA are kind of supposed to operate these days. So it isn't a world where we're actually protected by anyone anymore.
Thank you very much for your years of courage. I have two questions. One, are you selling books here? Yes? Great. And the second is, would you mind reviewing the research that you offered to review earlier about the comparison between the placebo effect and the effect of the medications? Just didn't quite follow it.
You are right. Okay. Just if I could ask you just a bit more about the bit that you didn't quite get. Was this the bit where I talked about the slides, doubt is our product? Okay, well, just quickly, let's quickly see if we can do this for you. Yeah, it's what the companies do quite well, and it's a shame, actually, I haven't got one or two more slides here to try and bring the point out. When you run a trial, these trials are usually designed to show the drug works. They aren't ever designed usually to bring out the risks that a drug can cause. So it may happen that you've got a large number of people in... let me actually just make a further point. One of the interesting things here perhaps is this. Most of us here in the room would feel, if we go to our doctor and we're told, look, I have a drug which has just been put into a clinical trial and there were 10 to 20 people in the trial, and we can offer you this treatment, or there was a drug that was put into a trial that had thousands of people in it, we can offer you that treatment. Most people instinctively, and most doctors would think the pill to give you is the one that was in the trial that had thousands of people in it. This sounds much more impressive. When in fact, if the treatment works, the example that I used about the people jumping out of the plane, you only need one person in the trial to show that the parachute works. The fewer the people in the trial, the better the pill is. Snake oil can be shown to work if you recruit thousands of people to the trial. Now, if you have a weak drug and you're trying to show it works and you recruit thousands of people, or at least hundreds of people, to the trial, you may also show that it has a risk, that it causes possibly heart attacks. And you may have a large number of people in the trial so that you can show that this risk is statistically significant. It's much more likely, even if you've recruited hundreds of people to the trial and you're testing drug B here, that you'll show the good thing that it can do, and the heart attacks that it can cause, well, they're there. There is an increased risk, but it's not statistically significant because the trial hasn't been organized to look at this. Trials really can only do one thing. They can't usually do two things. That is, they can look at the good thing the pill does, but they can't usually at the same time also look at what the full range of risks could be. Okay? So it'll turn out that there's an increased rate of heart attacks happening here, but the data is not statistically significant. In actual fact, how you should read this is drug B is four times riskier than drug A. What the companies say to you is, well, there's a chance, we concede drug A causes a problem. There's a chance, a small chance, an extraordinarily small chance, this much of a chance, that drug B doesn't cause the problem. And you're being asked to believe, because chance could have played a part, that there is no increase in risk. You're almost having an induced psychosis here. You've been asked not to believe the evidence of your own eyes. Okay? And worse again, we are training doctors these days the kinds of questions that they get asked. If they say drug B is riskier than drug A, they will fail their exams. So it's an extraordinary world that we're in at the moment. Yes, close to. It's extraordinary.
Mm. Hi. There was a study, I don't recall the source, a number of years ago, that the placebo effect counted to up to 70% of the favorable effect of some drugs. And I know some universities now are teaching more of the effect of bias and trying to point more toward evidence-based medicine, patient care algorithms, rather than, you know, putting bias as that impact. And the other specific focus is, you know, your treatment questionnaire, that the new website you've located, doesn't really isolate the effect of one drug, whereas many people that are on a drug are on multiple drugs, so it's difficult to separate out that impact versus what the interactions might be. So I wonder if you might speak to those.
Yeah, sure. One of two or three quick bits. One is, yes, you're absolutely right. There's a range of different universities that have put excellent programs in place to show the kinds of biases that companies get up to, the tricks that they play. For the most part, however, most of these departments still believe that control trials are the way forward. We do control trials because we shouldn't believe doctors and patients when they say particular things are happening to them. Now, control trials, don't get me wrong here, control trials are wonderfully useful. There is a tremendous place for control trials, particularly to show when treatments don't work. They're wonderful for that. But what we need to get back to is a culture where we do encourage doctors and patients to believe the evidence of their own eyes. In the case that you outlined about people being on a few different drugs, how do they know which is the pill that's actually causing the problem? Well, that's a very tricky issue. And you or I, on our own, if we're on three or four different pills and we think it's pill A or pill B or whatever that's caused, you know, the problem, we may not be right. But the way to answer that is not to get us to believe that we're not having a problem, but to get patients and doctors working as a team. If you've got the input from a few different people trying to weigh, is it drug A or drug B or drug C that is actually causing the problem, we've got a much better chance of getting the right answer. Not an absolute chance that we're going to get the right answer, but a much better chance. How I like to compare this, this may be a little risky, I don't know who I'm dealing with here. I'm Irish and Catholic background, so I can say this and maybe the rest of you can't. Freud taught us within the mental health field that we couldn't believe what patients said. Patients come along and talk about being abused. You can't believe it. And the Catholic Church went along with this for a long time, that you can't believe what people say. There's all kinds of reasons why, and there may be all kinds of motives about why they've come out with the things that they've come out with. And this is right. I mean, Freud did offer us a great breakthrough. He made us much more sensitive to the range of things that what people say can mean. You know, that it isn't always the case that the real communication is what appears to be on the surface. But as the church found out, ultimately, you know, you cannot keep saying that people are wrong when they claim they've been abused. It turns out that a lot of people were abused. In the same way, just the same way, I think, controlled trials said to us that we shouldn't believe the evidence of our own eyes. It's only when you do trials that you find out what the drug actually does. We're in a world, I think, where we're almost at the same kind of position that the Catholic Church was in vis-a-vis issues of abuse. There are injuries happening on pills, and people are being told you cannot believe the evidence of your own eyes. We have to tilt the balance back and say control trials are wonderful. They do bring out the biases that both doctors and patients can bring to treatment. They're extraordinarily useful from this point of view. But ultimately, at the end of the day, when things are happening right in front of your own eyes, you've got to put weight on that too. And that's what we've lost, I think.
Yeah, I actually have three questions. You said evidence versus data. Isn't evidence based on data? Was one of your slides. You said evidence versus data. The second question is, has the use of these antidepressants to prevent suicides in adults have undergone the same scrutiny, which of you have or others have this? And lastly, it's really easy to beat up on the big bad pharmaceutical companies. I don't know what the alternative to this. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, my favorite medical journal, it's talking about how much the expensive developing drugs and the trials and the question is whether it's working or not, this really have choked the pipeline for innovations in drug therapy.
Right, there was a whole bunch of points there, and I'm not sure that I can answer. Or you may need to prompt me. I agree with you that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times are in ways better medical journals, or could be, than the New England Journal of Medicine and other journals like this. And we might be all a lot safer if the trials that were done were published in things like the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, because journalists with papers like that check the integrity of the primary sources in a way that the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA and the BMJ don't. As regards the costs of bringing new drugs to the market, industry, as I've said, have choked off the adverse events that happen on drugs. They've made it awfully hard to report on things like this. But adverse events from drugs like Viagra to Latisse to the use of antibiotics for ulcers and all have been the way, the primary, most fruitful way to discover new drugs. Not only that, if we find a new use for a drug from an adverse event, it's going to be so much cheaper to bring this to the market because it's on the market to begin with. The companies don't need to go through a raft of new trials, put it through animal screening, do all of the other things that they have to do that cost huge amounts of money. These are drugs that are on the market that need to be that can be repurposed. It will vastly reduce the costs of bringing drugs to the market. So that's why this is awfully important. But just to take what I think was your first point, hopefully your first point, you said we shouldn't beat up on the pharmaceutical industry. I agree on that point completely. What I tried to do at the start was say that the industry and doctors and patients are all caught in a system. We need to change elements of the system, not the whole thing. I'm not talking about revolution. I'm talking about, I'm sure we've got the capabilities to tweak the system and make it work better for all of us. If anything, I thought I was beating up on doctors more than industry. The people who've potentially failed you in all this have been doctors. This isn't actually a system that has really worked as well for doctors as it has appeared to work. It's given them a secure living. It's given them lots of money, but it's deprived them of a lot of the professional role that they once had.
We're over time already, but it's such an interesting speaker and discussion, so there are three more people who want to ask questions, so it's okay. We'll ask the three more questions.
Okay. We were talking last night about hips and cataracts and antibiotics, three fairly clear success stories. I'm thinking about acute lymphocytic leukemia in children and the range of cancers in children that over a period of about 30 or 40 years where children used to regularly die from these conditions are now at least living into their 20s and 30s, and some of them apparently may have normal lives. The drug trials that were involved in establishing the multiple drug treatment regimens for these children, I don't know how familiar you are with them, and how would you characterize them as different from, let's say, testing for Zoloft in children?
Yeah. Larry, first of all, it would be a complete mistake to say that there haven't been great breakthroughs. There have been, and you've outlined a group of drugs that in particular are ones that really have made a huge difference. The loss of children prematurely is one of the worst things that can happen. But we're in a world where, while there are treatments that are curing illnesses that we do need cures for, it's all too likely that the person who gets out of the frying pan of one illness is then likely to be told, but their lipids are a bit raised and this, that, and the other, and they're going to end up being put on a bunch of drugs which are not going to treat an illness that needs to be cured. They're going to be treating risk factors. They're going to be treating an illness that isn't there. We need to retweak, and it's in this group of drugs, the drugs that treat illnesses that aren't there, illnesses that we might get that the industry makes its money from. In the case of the antibiotics or in the case of tumors, you treat to the point where the illness is cured and then the treatment stops. In the case of risk factors, the idea is you treat the person forever. We need to retweak the system that we have and get industry back to making the drugs that we need for the illnesses, for all of the cancers that are out there still that we don't have treatments for. We need to get industry making drugs that are going to increase our life expectancy. rather than producing drugs that, if anything, well, don't add to a life add to our life expectancy, and if anything, may actually reduce it.
I run a website, a peer support website called survivingantidepressants.org for antidepressant withdrawal syndrome. I've had antidepressant withdrawal syndrome myself for 7 years, and I appreciate the work you've done to bring this particular adverse effect. I know it's a sideline for you, but I appreciate your looking into it. I have a question about how all of this crappy research gets into the journals. Now there's a lot of information emerging about how the statistics have been jimmied by the pharmaceutical companies. It's pretty obvious that this is endemic, but particularly in psychiatry, which you've also pointed out. And is there any acknowledgement of this at Cochrane? A lot of doctors rely on the Cochrane reviews for summarizing the best information about drugs. In medical journals in general, why aren't the statistics being even checked in even a cursory fashion?
The Cochrane Review group recently dealt with just this issue. There's a group of articles in the BMJ on Cochrane reviews of drugs for flu. And they concluded that they had tried to review whether the drugs that were used for flu work or not. And the first reviews had said that they did work. They weren't all that great, but that they worked. But later, the Cochrane reviewers came to the conclusion that they hadn't been able to get access to all of the data. And every extra bit of data that they began to get access to began to point more and more to the fact that these drugs didn't work for flu. And the ultimate conclusion, it's not spelt out too clearly, but it's there, that actually we're in a world where it may not be possible to write guidelines for any illness anymore without access to the data. That again and again it appears to be that once we have access to all the data, it looks a very different picture to the kinds of picture we have been going on when we're just working from the published data. But there's a huge guideline industry out there. A lot of people totally independent of industry, who have no links to industry at all. They're writing guidelines to try and contain industry. And, of course, you try and tell them that guidelines aren't a good idea and that maybe we should, you know, maybe we're in a world where we have to abandon guidelines, and you're going to find them not very enthusiastic. I'll give you one more quick point. All medical journals these days operate... they link up to and operate through the Committee on Publication Ethics, COPE. This kind of sounds wonderful. It's good to hear that JAM and the New England Journal of Medicine, BMJ and Lancet all get together and actually discuss the issues that we've just been through here, sort of how fake articles get into journals and things like that. The current chair of COPE is a medical ghostwriter.
I have a question in terms of use of personalized medicine, as well as maybe even the quantified self movement, in terms of figuring out whether for a certain pattern or kind of behavior in terms of depression, if you use certain kinds of drugs, that particular drug is better for, you know, a type of behavior before they take the drug, or through genetic makeup, you could figure out of, you know, 20 choices, which are the best for that particular person.
I don't think you can know beforehand which is actually going to be the best. I mean, this is the kind of thing where it is a shame given how many people have had the statins, the antidepressants, and any of the other big the drugs that have really earned a fortune for industry. We should, you would think, at this stage be at a point where we could, when you walk in the door to your doctor, that he or she should be able to say beforehand with a few simple tests and a few and maybe a few fairly straightforward questions, they should be able to work out which is the best drug among the range of drugs we have for you. But we just can't do it. The only thing we can do, the most personalized medicine we can have at this point in time, is if you have a doctor who is not looking at the computer screen, who says to you, look, there's a real risk that I haven't got the right drug for you. You and I need to work as a team to keep an eye on what happens to you when you get put on a pill. And if there's any hints that things aren't going right, we need to change the arrangements, which may just involve changing the dose. It may involve changing to a different drug which will do the same thing. Or it may not involve a drug at all. It's wonderful to be able to use drugs when they work, but it's an even greater medical art when you're doctor is able to find ways to help you without using drugs. Well, the curious thing about trials is they're wonderfully designed really to bring out the benefits of drugs. It's very, very hard to show that different approaches other than drugs work well in controlled trials. Every so often when trials are done, there's one extremely famous trial done of dental hygienists compared with dentists to see just in terms of your tooth healthcare on a range of different outcomes. This trial was done and it showed that dental hygienists give just the same outcomes as dentists did, and the consequence of the trial was that the local university-affiliated dental hygiene school closed down.
Okay, our thanks to Dr. David Healy for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating the 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.